Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. Kingmaker. Secrets, lies, and the truth about five prime ministers. David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak's five prime ministers. One explosive memoir. Kingmaker lifts the lid on the leadership battles that have defined British politics over the past decade, to put it mildly. I'm delighted to say that the author of Kingmaker, Lord Graham Brady, joins me live on the line now. Lord Brady, good morning to you, sir.
Morning. Good to be with you.
You described the Kingmaker. It was your chance of putting things on the record, because you had to keep, in your own words, tight-lipped about your opinions at the time. Explain to perhaps those who don't know what your role was. Chairman of the 1922 committee?
Exactly. So I'd been a Member of Parliament for 13 years at that point, but 2010, my colleagues elected me as chairman of the 1922 committee, essentially the chairman of the Parliamentary Conservative Party. And one of the roles that committee has is looking after matters relating to the leadership, votes of confidence, this strange mechanism we had where a certain percentage of the parliamentary party writing letters to the chairman could trigger a confidence vote. All of these things had to be kept completely confidential, completely secret. But of course, it was a tumultuous and fascinating time in politics. So one of the things that people frequently said to me when they stopped me in the street in London or elsewhere or on the tube was, "Do you hope you're going to write a book one day?" And I suppose I'd always had it in mind that I would when I was 80, but it did seem like after that really intense period of a few years, it was a very good time to do it.
You joined the Conservative Party very early on. Was what, 16, 17?
16, yes.
And then you became
a campaign to save my own grammar school.
Ah, fair enough, because you're originally from Salford. Is it Salford in Manchester?
I'm born in Salford, but I grew up in Altrincham, and I'm an Altrincham Grammar School boy, and then had the huge privilege of going on for 27 years, seven parliaments, representing my hometown in the House of Commons.
It's a fascinating time to be a Conservative. I mean, I famously describe myself as Conservative with a small C. And the party itself has been through some, can we say, interesting, memorable changes in that time since because we're roughly the same age, since those sort of early, you know, late 80s, early 90s days?
It was so simple when Margaret Thatcher was there. Everybody knew where they stood. Certainly there have been some big events, some big challenges to be faced. It's been an interesting time for the party, but an interesting time for the country and for the world. We've all faced some things that we didn't think would happen. And, you know, I suppose in a way I'd go right the way back to the period you refer to, the end of the Cold War. The Berlin Wall came down the year that I graduated from university. It seemed like the whole world was set fair for peace, democracy, prosperity, and it doesn't seem quite so positive at the moment. But then looking at the more recent period, as I became chairman of the 1922 committee, and it's very much the period I write about in Kingmaker, the experience of coalition government, that's something we don't normally do in Britain. We have a system of electoral system that's meant to deliver clear outcomes and normally does, sometimes a bit too clear, as it did last year. But then going on from coalition government, we then had the whole debate over whether to leave or remain in the European Union. We had a referendum result, which was a surprise, certainly to the establishment, and took then with no significant majority in Parliament. It was almost impossible to do that, even though the instruction had been given in the referendum. Then Theresa May, of course, decided when she went for a walk in the Alps with her husband and the air was a little bit thin, she decided to have another general election in 2017. And the outcome of that was that we ended up with no majority at all and still facing the challenge of delivering a complicated solution to leaving the European Union. And then just as everything was resolved, 2019, we have a big majority. Boris Johnson has become prime minister and gone to the country and got an 80-seat majority. And then a couple of months later, we end up with the COVID pandemic and all of the challenges that came from that. So it's been an extraordinary period. And I think any party, any group of people would have faced challenges in dealing with it. But it did feel like history had sped up.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure it's so true.
I mean, you talk about that first point, and when I was doing some television, because obviously based in southern Spain, had the, as they call it over here, El Brezi, had a huge effect on those of us living over here. And I remember doing, we were doing live ITV Good Morning Britain, and David Cameron came out and made that speech, and it was, and Donald Trump was in, you know, was in Scotland at the time as well, and suddenly everything that we thought was going to sort of bumble along quite nicely, and you say times everything sped up, but that was the first indicator that this was going to be, shall we say, an interesting ride, Lord Brodie.
Exactly. And I mean, in my book, I try to tell some serious stories and make some serious points, but also some of the quite entertaining stories. And one of those was that the entire British media thought that whatever the outcome of the referendum, it was going to be a difficult day for the Conservative Party. So they had all booked me for the early morning media round on the Friday morning. So I started off at 5:45 in the morning, and I was doing the Today programme and doing Good Morning Britain, and I was on the sofa in the studios and doing regional radio everywhere. And every interview started with the question, isn't it now essential that David Cameron should resign as prime minister? And I was getting quite into my stride in answering, on the contrary, this is a time of uncertainty. It's essential that David Cameron remains prime minister to begin to chart a course for our exit from the European Union, to allow the markets to settle, provide some certainty for the voters. And then about the 20th time I was doing this live on BBC television on the green just opposite the Palace of Westminster, as I could see on the monitor in front of me, the door of number 10 Downing Street opening, and David Cameron striding out to a lectern, and Cameron resigns appearing on the screen, which was one of those broadcasting moments.
How do you prepare? I mean, you can't really prepare for that, but I mean, you know, this is the problem. You're, as you said, you're into your stride, everything's going well, you're looking forward to perhaps to something to celebrate the end of a tiring day, a round of interviews, and of course the media, I mean the mainstream media, whatever you want to call it, immediately wants a reaction from you. And do you have somebody sort of literally, you know, screaming in your ear or waving a paper frantically off screen to say, you know, to try and give you a briefing, because, you know, you're on your own.
Maybe if you're a government minister, you have that. But if you're chairing the backbench group, then you don't. And I suppose what's just essential is to know what your duty is, know what your role is, know what you have to deliver. So when I saw David Cameron resigning and the journalist said to me, so in the new circumstances, what do you think now? And I said, well, in the new circumstances, it's essential that we move as swiftly and seamlessly as possible to have a new leader and prime minister in place so that we can have somebody to chart a course in leaving the EU, allow the markets to settle and provide some certainty and calm. So I had no doubt in my mind that the thing that was most important, whether you'd voted to leave as I did or to remain, the most important thing was to have some stability and calm and not allow anybody to start to panic and say, oh, we didn't know this was going to happen and have turbulence in the markets and so on. It was really important that we had that period of stability while people worked out where they were going to go.
But the thing is, had this been 30 years ago, before internet, social media, all that came on board, then you could have put a period of stability. But obviously, with the sort of free-for-all frenzy that we have, there was obviously that in Brexit, and people are coming up with their ideas. And then, of course, we get hit with the lockdown, the pandemic, and of course this allows people to go, you know, turbo nuclear with their theories. And the 1922 commission has been described, and you probably hate this, as the men in grey suits, i.e. stable, not grabbing the headlines. And suddenly it seemed that every day was a headline, every day was a drama.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'd have to say, actually, I think when the men in grey suits was a phrase that came to prominence some decades ago, actually, that was the group of people who went to tell the prime minister that his time was up and he ought to go. And I procedures were a little bit different in more recent years. But certainly it was a very strange and completely unexpected thing. When I became chairman of the 1922 committee, I thought that would be almost entirely behind the scenes. And then I became one of the best known faces, I suppose, in British politics. Mostly, I have to say, it was a really lovely experience, because in a strange way, members of the public, I think, didn't see me as a political figure. They saw me as a kind of a referee, and they thought I was there to make sure everything was done properly and decency prevailed and that elections were fair and free and so on. So I really never had any unpleasantness. I had, you know, endless conversations with people on the tube, in the street, wherever I went, but pretty much always friendly. And what came across to me very much was that almost always what people wanted was a bit of certainty, a bit of calm. And they would ask me sometimes, we just had one of these big events, a confidence vote in a prime minister, whatever it might be. And they'd stop me in the street and say, Graham, we are going to have a bit of calm now, aren't we? And I'd try to reassure them. But I say in the book that one of the things that, you know, I didn't go into politics to calm people down. I wanted to, you know, excite people with ideas about freedom and liberty and prosperity. But I ended up being better known for sort of calming people down when they were in a bit of a state of near panic.
But here's the thing, because yes, you want to go into politics to make a difference, make a change. But we go into politics not to sort of turn the whole thing 180 and shake it and get rid of this and get rid of that and, you know, start a brave new world, because we're British and we like to have certain things. You know, certain things like to kick, you know, keep going on, like the monarchy, like, you know, whatever, you know, your view, grammar schools, your view of what it means to be British. And that's sort of front and centre of obviously what we're going through at the moment. So whilst we can have these wild prophets of doom, on the internet and on whatever social media, the bottom line is that we like to believe that we're a decent, humane nation and decent, humane people, Graham.
And things should really evolve and not be done by revolutionary change. And, you know, I guess, I mean, years ago, I was Shadow Europe Minister, spokesman for the Conservative Party on Europe. At that point, we were advocating a rebalancing of the relationship so that we brought more powers back to Britain. We were advocating a more flexible structure. And, you know, if people had accepted that, probably we would have had that more revolutionary change. I don't know where it would have ended up. But it was because the establishment in Britain and in the EU ignored the frustration and the irritation with the increasing integration and the fact that too many powers were going to the centre, that you end up with things then moving to the point of a more revolutionary change like the referendum outcome. But I'd also say in the COVID response, and in a way I think the most important part of my book is the references to how those decisions were made in terms of the response to COVID. I think we also got that profoundly wrong, because that fundamental balance that we've always had in Britain between the rights of the citizen and the power of the state always used to accept that the government was there to serve the people. It wasn't there to tell people what to do. And of course, we ended up with those minute detailed instructions as to what you were allowed to do. You're allowed to leave the house once a day and to do one form of exercise. It was all absurd and probably did a lot more harm than any good that it might have done. But it certainly was crossing a line where the state started telling people what they should do in every aspect of their lives.
Yeah, you know, interesting, because we were sitting in Spain, which had obviously restrictions like you wouldn't believe, and we were looking at some of the people sort of sitting on the beaches in Brighton and thinking, you know, a lot of us weren't allowed to go out further than sort of 30 metres in one province, 100 metres if you had your dog in another. It really was quite a time. But I suppose the problem was that there was a disconnect suddenly, and then there were, which has been well covered, obviously, the various breaking of regulations, and it became sort of us and them. A very challenging time, Lord Brady, for yourselves and those in the 1922 committee.
It was a challenging time, but thank heavens there are some people who got it right. And we can look at the Swedes, who, to their credit, never locked down, never closed their schools, and came out of COVID pretty much the same as most other countries did. You can look at Florida. I had a friend who was in Florida through most of that time, and I'd speak to him on the phone. He'd say, well, you can only go to a pub if you have a Scotch egg, and you've got to sit outside with no more than five other people. He said, yeah, we're having a lovely meal here in a restaurant in Florida. Nothing has changed. And there was a point where December 2020, I tell the story in the book, we got so frustrated we couldn't work out what was going to happen at Christmas. I booked for me and my grown-up children and my wife, we flew off to Antigua for Christmas and New Year. And yes, they had a curfew at midnight, which they extended to 1 o'clock in the morning on New Year's Eve. Otherwise, life was going on pretty much as normal.
You kept a diary during this. You kept a journal, presumably, and this is what you refer back to. Did you always think you were going to write? I mean, you said you were going to write them when you were 80, but I suppose it was more immediate because of the situation that the UK finds itself in now.
Absolutely. I mean, I've got to say, I'm not disciplined enough to write a detailed diary every day. And, you know, I have huge respect for people like Tony Benn, who did do that throughout a very long career. But what I did do was make notes of things which I thought were extraordinary, and some of the things that were said that were extraordinary, and just kept a record of those. And that was hugely helpful. When I sat down to write the book, I had a kind of framework of some of the key events and some unique takes on what happened and why. One of the examples, actually, which I'd completely forgotten, but thankfully I'd made a note at the time, was a conversation I had with Boris Johnson when I went in to see him at the height of all of the public anger about Dominic Cummings and his breach of lockdown when he drove to Barnard Castle with his family. And I went to say to Boris, you know, people are furious, he's got to go. And Boris initially, he said, well, you don't accept Dom's version of events? And I said, well, of course I don't accept his version of events. It's obvious, I don't know, I can say on the radio, so BS, I'll say.
Yes, but well done.
I said, no sane person would put their wife and small child in the car and drive 30 miles to test their eyesight. Whereupon Boris's wonderful response was, he's insane. So that was the case for the defence.
But there was that stuff. I mean, I was watching that. We were watching, you know, on our TV screens that incredible sort of summer afternoon in the garden at Downing Street. And then literally 30 seconds in, I turned to my colleague, in our production studio and went, he's not going to go. He's not going to go. And it was talk about shock and awe.
So extraordinary. But, you know, I think, you know, the core of it was those extreme restrictions on people's lives. And I think what you saw there was a mismatch between the view of a lot of the people who were involved in setting the restrictions, who probably had a better understanding of COVID and the relative risks of COVID than most of the public did, because the government set about trying to frighten the public. And this is all on the record. The advertising campaigns were deliberately intended to heighten anxiety, quote, in order to increase compliance. So the people were being worked up into a state of fear, anxiety, people responded to that in all sorts of different ways. Some people got angry, other people lost all of their confidence. There are people who still don't go out very much because they never got back to normal.
Mm. And I remember that sort of period when government ministers were resigning en masse every, you know, it was a running count. And then there's this sort of snowball effect, isn't there? Because, Johnson goes and then Truss comes in, and we'll just go over that very quickly indeed, which sort of gave Sunak
It happened very quickly, didn't it?
Yeah, indeed. And then so Sunak was on a bit of a hiding to nothing, wasn't he? Because he was like holding the hot potato. And you just thought, you know, you had to, I mean, you and people will be shouting at the wireless now, but you had to feel for him in a way, because, you know, we hope he's a decent human being, but there was no way he was going to be able to sort of hold on to that no matter what he said.
I think that's probably true. And, you know, I think that Rishi is a completely decent person. He's oddly, although famously, he's very wealthy. A lot of people say, well, how can he possibly relate to normal people? I found him far more normal than most senior politicians, and you know, really quite an easy person to chat to get along with, and no discernible ego at all, which is very unusual in senior people in politics. So, you know, I think he must have known when he stepped in and took on the job that it was going to be hellishly difficult. He was, stabilizing things, bringing things back from a very difficult situation, and he did that very well, along with Jeremy Hunt. I think if there was a criticism, he then needed to move to taking a few political risks and offering a little bit of excitement to people who maybe wanted to vote Conservative but were rather disillusioned. But to be fair, I think it's also possible that even if he'd done that and offered some more enticing, exciting policies, it may have made no difference. Because I think there does come a time in politics where people just make their minds up. Mm. And you know, I think what had happened by 2023 into 2024, people had just decided that the Conservative Party seems to be in a mess, and they've had all of these different leaders, and we had the Liz Truss thing that lasted 49 days, and they absolutely didn't like the alternative that was on offer. And they were very unenthusiastic about it, but they were determined to have a change. And they ended up, of course, with a big Labour majority secured with 34% of the vote, which is a very strange outcome.
And then appearing on the right flank, just to make, you know, like as the end of the peer show, and I'll just ask you this about this quickly, little Brady, because again, I said at the beginning, Conservative with a small C, and then you see, you know, Reform suddenly, men in very blue suits arriving in the House of Commons. And the paper, people are decrying, the media is decrying the death of the Conservative Party. It's all over. Labour is giving them Reform credence by targeting them in their sort of riposts. Are we premature in saying that's it for the Conservatives? They're going to go the way of the Whigs and the Liberals, and that will be it for the Conservative Party.
I think it is premature. And, you know, I'm old enough to have lived through the SDP polling 50% and then crashing and burning in a general election. So, you know, I think it would be a very big ask for Reform to become the biggest party, whatever the current opinion polls say. But I think there's a more fundamental problem for Reform, which is that they're still having to decide which way they face. They made their early moves were all targeting the Conservative Party and saying that we were being too weak on immigration or whatever. What we're now seeing, they're targeting the Labour Party, which has got far more members of Parliament, a lot of them with very small majorities, and a lot of them with Reform in second place in the general election last year. And to do that, Reform seems to be positioning itself economically on the left, where they're talking about higher benefits. They seem to be wanting to increase spending whilst also saying they would cut taxes. And the logical outcome of that would be even more borrowing. I think actually the serious gap in British politics now is for a proper Conservative Party, which is fiscally conservative, and will tell some uncomfortable truth to people about what needs to be done really to straighten the public finances out and straighten the economy out. And in a way, you could say that by the time of the next general election, we might be back to something a bit like 1978-79, where it's just obvious that somebody needs to come in and talk sense and straighten things out.
Since you put, because the book came out, was it like end of last year? And it's coming out in paper? Yeah.
It came out in the autumn last year, yes, and in hardback, and just out now in paperback.
And was there any sort of response? I mean, did you have a knock on the door or a phone call or a text message? Or because obviously we've got five prime ministers in there.
No, I didn't. But I think that the Conservative Party generally has responded rather well to the book. And I think people are really keen to know what happened and try to understand it. So one of the things I hadn't entirely expected, but has been quite nice and enjoyable, as well as doing all the book festivals, and that's very pleasant. I've been invited to do a lot of events for Conservative Party audiences. So while we're going about the country to speak at the literary festival in Stratford-on-Avon or whatever, we're also doing a local Conservative Party event. And you know, I think what broadly people just take the view I find that far too many of my colleagues leaked everything in real time. And it was as though, you know, cabinet meetings went on in public sometimes. When it mattered, I didn't leak anything. I kept complete confidence. But now I think a lot of people think it's quite helpful to be able to look at what actually happened and why.
Yeah, and the right period of time to be able to take a step back. It's a fascinating insight. The book is called Kingmaker. Listeners, you can order it via our own virtual bookstore. There is a photograph of the front cover, Secrets, Lies, and the Truth About Five Prime Ministers. It's by Zoe Grady. And if people want to find you, do you dabble now on the internet? Can people find you online?
You can find me via the House of Lords. There's a website. You can contact a member of the House of Lords that way.
And as I said before, you can order the order book via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Kingmakers by Lord Brady. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Indeed. Thank you very much for having me.